Okay, Blogging Heads viewers, we have a real treat today. With me is the author of Dead Right, one of the most cutting critiques of modern conservatism, How We Got Here, the best book on the 1970s, The Right Man, a memoir of his time at the White House, and An End to Evil with Richard Perle, also a contributor to the National Review. If you're watching at home, please put your hands together for David Frum. David, thanks so much for coming on to Blogging Heads TV.
Thanks, Eli. You know, the thing I had never realized about Blogging Heads TV is you have to look at yourself on the camera, not the person you're talking to, and that's kind of depressing, actually.
Yes. Well, let's get things started. One of you have, in David Frum's diary, which you can read on National Review online, you've got a rather lengthy sort of, I think now, three-part section review on Bob Novak's memoir, Prince of Darkness. I believe Richard Perle, by the way, might be suing for copyright infringement on that title.
I think Novak had it first, and, yes. and with better justice.
Yes, yes, indeed. So tell me, there's an interesting section, passage of the book, and I haven't read it yet, that sort of gets into his many problems with you. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah. One of the things that is really weird about the book is the book is very much about settling scores. Most of the stories in it are not that interesting. I guess he printed the good stuff or is maybe saving it for later. But he is very eager to settle scores on the Wilson Plain matter and to settle scores with me. And his language about me is probably the harshest in the book. I sort of understand that. I wrote a pretty scathing article that referred to him. I mean, it wasn't about him in 2003. What I was struck by, I'm struck by many things. I'm struck by the fact that, like, in the section he wrote about me, Washington's greatest reporter, like, factual error after factual error. He gets the restaurant we had lunch wrong. He gets the date wrong. He gets the address of my house wrong, although he's been there. Makes you wonder. But, you know, what we is part of, I think, a post-debate. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, a number of people on the right reacted. People had been very alienated from the United States during the Clinton years. Reacted in a way that was resonant of Noam Chomsky and Michael Moore, and Novak was one of them.
The chickens coming home to
exactly.
roost thesis.
We brought it on ourselves. More than that, I mean, that Novak wrote a column in September 2001 accusing the United States of wanting to pulverize Afghanistan at a time when just enormous lengths were being gone to protect innocent civilian life and to avert a famine. And conservatives would have found it shocking had it come from the other side of the quadrant, but it was some of our own who did it, and I wrote about that. And I would have thought that with the passage of time, there would have been some wisdom, and you know, we all say things that may in the heat of the moment. But instead, I think a number of the people in that quadrant have responded to my criticism by saying, "Oh, I was only criticizing them for their stance on Iraq." I have to say, I'd always given these so-called paleoconservatives the credit for the courage of their bad convictions, but it turns out they don't even have that.
Right. Well, I mean, listen, if you read The American Conservative today, it's in many ways an anti-American publication. And they are obsessed with, people like you and me as sort of, you know, undermining the American national interest. But they print guys like Justin Raimondo, who is just, at this point, we'd have to say, an apologist for America's enemies. He's sort of, Iran can do no wrong in the Raimondo view. I mean, I think that you in many ways sort of predicted a trend among a certain strain in the right that we are somehow owed this terrorism. And I would just add it's insulting to a lot of Iraqis because the people who are the victims right now of al-Qaeda's aggressions are our most Iraqi civilians. And, you know, by far the death toll is much more in the Arab column than the
I think, look, this is a constant problem that we conservatives have, and I can't claim to be immune to it. Conservatives are people who often have a kind of grudging attitude toward changes that happen in their society. They look around and they grumble. They're like the grouchy old man on the porch. And one of the things that conservatives need to do is to always make a special effort to keep in mind their commitment and affinity for their society, regardless of the fact that it sometimes does change in ways that they find uncongenial. I think what happened in the late 1990s, and for some conservatives going all the way back, well, into the 1970s and 60s, is that American society changed in ways that they found stressful and they have, and then in this moment of crisis after 9/11, they found it very hard to rally to a society from which they felt so alienated. And I suppose that the lesson to all of us is don't become grouchy old men.
Yeah, I think so. Well, if I could just get back to Novak, and of course I don't agree with what he has to say about you. As a journalist, though, I would say I can understand why non-journalists wouldn't like his approach to sources and targets. But when I read that sort of thing, I'm like, you go, Bob. That's terrific. I mean, I think that that is the view of someone whose job it is to get people in government to tell them things they're not supposed to. And Bob Novak is so aggressive at it and sort of wields such a big stick and is so sort of blunt and open about the fact that, you know, there's only two kinds of people in this world, sources and targets, that as a journalist, the journalist in me just appreciates
you
his
do.
Chutzpah.
The problem with these, that is the famous line of his. He doesn't quote in the book, but I know I don't have friends, I have sources and I have targets. The problem is, and not just with me, but with many others, and he boasts about it in the book, is with his targets, he does not feel any special obligation to be strictly accurate. And I think, you know, at some level, you know, at some level, this is a temptation to journalism, to journalists. I mean, one of the questions that journalists have to, one of the great ethical lines that journalists have to remember is they're people, too, and the normal rules of moral conduct apply to them. And journalists are susceptible to the temptations of power. And yes, of course, you need to ferret out information on behalf of your readers. But when you, that can very easily evolve into a desire for power as an end in itself, and then an abuse of your power. I mean, one of the things that we're all tempted to, but I just think about this all the time, is my wife will tease me because we have a bad experience with a moving company. I won't write a column about that because somebody else can't write a column about it.
Right.
And there's a kind of whiff of blackmail that you often see in some kinds of journalism. And I think it's wrong. It's abuse of power. And when it is about your own ego and maximizing your own importance and making sure that attention is on you, then it's really corrupt. Corruption can occur without money.
Right.
And
you have an awfully nice reputation, Mr. Fromm. I would hate to see anything happen to it.
That's it. One of the people who is one of the targets of his book is Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson is a friend of mine. I'm a lovely guy. I think a great TV talent. What is Tucker Carlson's huge offense is he writes about Bob Novak in a book without flattering him. He says, Bob Novak, a 70-year-old journalist who had been a co-host of Crossfire since the 1980s. And Novak goes, this is intolerable, because you have to say the Washington legend, that you're extorting a level of deference from the society through the threat of the abuse of journalistic power. I think that's corrupt.
Yeah, I think that that's a very interesting, that's an important argument. And it's one, I think, to think about in terms of Novak, and especially in terms of this memoir, which seems pretty self-serving based on reading your reviews and some of the other things I've read about it. I will say this. I read his column because he gets news.
Mm-hmm.
And he still gets news, which is a lot more than I can say for Eric Alterman. I don't know the last time he wrote news. You know what I mean? I mean, there's a lot of other people who have columns who don't manage to tell me something I don't already know. And Bob Novak manages to do that. I think he runs into trouble when he tries to sort of, you know, tie it all together in a theory or and so forth, but he's a hell of a reporter.
He gets news, but much of it is true.
Yeah, much of it is true. I mean, that's what I would say. Anyway, moving on from Bob Novak, I would like to get this opportunity because I'm interviewing you, so I want to talk about my favorite book that you've written, which is your book on the 1970s, which it was published in 2000 before you joined the Bush White House, and I would recommend the viewers to read it because it is, I think, a pretty devastating critique of how the counterculture revolutionary values of the 1960s seeped into everyday American life in the 1970s. So kind of looking back 7 years after you've written that, where do you see today the residue of that generation and of the 1970s real kind of popular culture reformation, and what have America sort of gotten beyond?
Well, I think one of the big themes of that book was that my computer just went off. There we go. One of the big themes of that book was that people of a certain age have a kind of nostalgia for American life as it was in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And I argue that this is kind of anomalous, that this that mid-century world, whether you liked it as ordered and stable or whether you hated it as conformist and crushing, that was an artifact of depression and war. And you look at the way the big company, it was dominated by big companies, it was dominated by big labor, government had a kind of role that it hasn't had since. And that what happened in the late 1970s was that society went through a systemic crisis. It could not solve its problems, economic problems, political problems. It couldn't win wars. And that mid-century consensus broke apart and opened up the way to the new world we live in now. And this is not just an ideological point, because one of the things that changed in the 1970s is America began to reappear as a much more unequal society than it had been through much of the 20th century. It reverted to the inequalities that you saw in the 19th century and in the early part of the 20th century. And when you say what it holds today, you know, that theme of inequality is one of the great dominant themes of modern American life. And what we're seeing, I think one form of the inequality is goes to these countercultural norms you talked about. We are seeing, and I talk a little bit about this in the book that I remember, a remoralization of the top half of American society. If you are a college graduate getting married in the year 2007, you are much less likely to get divorced than a college graduate getting married in the year 2007, that you've actually had some social learning. Marriage has been reconfigured in a way that is more consistent with the aspirant people, and especially modern women. And so your life is probably more stable, and your birth rate has gone up a little bit. Meanwhile, in the bottom half of American society, the changes that loosed in the 1960s and popularized in the 1970s, those just rage. And in the bottom half of society, marriage has become very rare, and all kinds of social problems that were consistent with the 1970s continue. And the more I think about it, the more I worry, and this, I think, is one of the things that, I mean, it's not appropriate, I'm told, for conservatives to worry about it, but there's some level of inequality that frightened people like John Adams. He wrote about this a lot. And maybe we're approaching a level where it needs to frighten us a little bit, too, with modern conservatives.
Let me ask you, I mean, you brought up John Adams. Do you think that America is capable of what John Adams called the common reason, which will be a kind of corrective to extreme and wrong policy?
I think American institutions are. I'm a big consumer of all this public choice literature that suggests that it takes a lot of art to translate popular preferences. It's even meaningless to talk about popular preferences, to translate them into policy. America has been pretty successful at doing that. And I think in some ways it remains successful. And one of the things that I marvel at in Washington, I haven't been here that long, a decade, but it's unbelievably bitter. I mean, unbelievably, when I compare it to what I read, much more bitter than in the past. And yet the differences are so small compared to the past. I mean, substantively, the difference between a Hillary Clinton and a George W. Bush is infinitesimal compared to the difference that there once was between a Bob Taft and a Belt. And yet the level of vitriol and anger. You've never seen people more. I mean, maybe this is a common phenomenon, that people angrier and angrier about differences that are smaller and smaller. There's an old joke about the Soviet Union where the ghost of the Tsar appears to Leonid Brezhnev in a dream and goes through all the changes, and Leonid Brezhnev finally, everything, of course, is exactly the same, and finally explains that the vodka, however, has a little bit more alcohol in it used to do. And the Tsar said, for four proof, you made a revolution. And I think there's something about that in our contemporary Washington.
Well, we know the Founding Fathers did terrible things to each other when they started running for office.
Mm-hmm.
We can find examples of all kinds of, I mean, the forerunner to the Swift Boat campaign in some ways might be like the Tyler campaign. I mean, you can argue, you can kind of go back and you can find all kinds of this stuff.
It was James Madison who engineered the leak of the information about Alexander Hamilton's extramarital affair. They weren't holy men. And they had very large differences. And compared to that, our differences look pretty small. And, I think part of that, and that goes maybe back to some of the themes of that 70s book. I mean, you know, and this maybe goes to some of the troubles that our modern Republican Party is in. The Democratic Party, although it is shifting now a little to the left from where it was, say, in 1998, 1999, 2000, is a much more conservative institution than it was in the 1970s and 1980s. I mean, certainly Hillary Clinton is a much more conservative political figure, has become a much more conservative political figure, or is at least expressing more conservative ideas than Michael Dukakis ever did. And because of the Democratic move to the right, that has put the Republicans in kind of a quandary, where a lot of economic issues have been taken off the table. Or else the Republicans are driven a kind of position of extremism that makes them, I mean, it's gratifying to me in some ways, but electorally troubled.
Well, I mean, culturally, I think you're right. I mean, the, you know, Hillary Clinton wants to ban violent video games, but, you know, on national security and the war, I see, you know, an almost return to at least McGovern's rhetoric with Hillary Clinton, if not the McGovern policies, with some of what we'd say, you know, our leaders of the Congress right now. So, I mean, I think it depends on the issue that you look at. But what I find interesting is that right now, and almost, I mean, it's interesting just to me, I don't think that the Iraq War is anything like the Vietnam War, but I was hoping that you would sort of get into this idea that, you know, the latest Washington Post ABC News poll today that was that just came out has, it's, you know, once, you know, I think something like at least 65% of Americans favor withdrawal of troops by some point in April next year. I think it's because they think this is a Vietnam, and whereas maybe in the 1960s and the early 1970s you had the hard hats, you know, versus the hippies, the view that don't trust the government, it's always lying to you, question authority, is now a very popular sentiment.
Well, you know, I think we can see in both cases, though, that what sustains anti-war feeling in the United States beyond the political fringes is pessimism. People support wars when they're optimistic about the war's outcome. And so long as they're optimistic, they'll accept tremendous sacrifices. The moment that they become pessimistic, it gets much, much harder. You know, the American ability to cohere, I just finished reading a fantastic book called Hitler's Beneficiaries by a German writer named Götz Ali, and he's talking about the way that Hitler financed World War II, first confiscation of the Jews of Germany, then confiscation of the Jews of Europe, and then finally the enslavement and destruction of the people of Eastern Europe, France, and the other conquered states. But one of the points he makes in passing was that during World War II, the United States and Britain accepted a level of centralization of economic resources that the Germans, under the Nazi socialist dictatorship, Nazi national socialist dictatorship, never accepted. Taxes were higher in Churchill's Britain than they were in Hitler's Germany. Americans gave up more of their income in the form of force, highly conscripted savings in the form of war bonds, and Germans did. Democratic societies will do that, but they require optimism. And I think one of the things that, you know, justice to the American public, that, I mean, it's hard for those of us who supported this war and continue to support it to say, look, here's the path. And to the extent, our battle, I think, on Iraq is not so much with the left. It is with the facts. If we can show Americans that there is success, that the war is important, that it protects American security, if we can make that argument again and again, they will follow. They will follow. They always have. And get into trouble is when we lose the ability to do that. And that's why some of the problems that the Bush administration has had articulating its, not only its beliefs, but because the president talks a lot about his vision and can be very eloquent about that, but what happens next and what happens next after that. I've often thought that the speech I would like to see George Bush do is to stand in the map room of the White House surrounded by maps with a laser pointer, and just to talk without notes, which he can do. People don't think he can, but he can, and explain what has been achieved, what the mistakes were, where we're going. If he can convince Americans that he knows what he's doing, that he has a clear plan, that there's reason to have confidence in the plan, the public will be there. And then you don't have to wait on Edwards and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, much less MoveOn.org, have to say.
Yeah, I think that there, yeah, I mean, this is a straying up, but it's good that we sort of get into it. I think, though, that David, the deal is David Petraeus in a month or so will give his report on Iraq. And we now have the Democratic Party and probably a third of the Republican Party in the Senate having already made up their minds without hearing his presentation, and it looks like the public has fixed an opinion on that. And since I don't accept that General Petraeus is some sort of neocon plant, you know, he's got every reason to sort of, you know, for his own advancement in his career, to be straight about it. And I don't understand why we're prejudging, you know, his report on the war. And incidentally, I would say that, you know, from what he said and from what, you know, David Kilcullen and other people around him have said, we're finally doing a lot better, and that there is a sort of path under which, you know, we can succeed. And I think he's prepared to articulate that, but he's going to need more time. That seems fairly reasonable. But I wonder, and sort of getting back to the 1970s book, if he can make that presentation. I mean, or is it basically like, yeah, you know, we've heard this from guys in uniforms before. You know, of course he's going to say that. Let's just get
one of the big arguments I make in the 1970s book is that you can train the trust in public institutions, and it begins before Vietnam. It begins in about 1966, and when Vietnam is a very or reasonably popular war, and it continues. And I don't think Vietnam was the cause of problems. I think the failure in Vietnam was the result of a lot. It was the result of bad military results too, but it was the result of these changes in American society. Some of those changes are permanent, but the society also became, you know, more conservative in a lot of ways. Look, I think if David Petraeus comes back in September, and there are successes that he can tell. If he tells those successes, and if the president backs him and explains, here are the reasons that to continue with this plan. Here's what we get out of this. Why Iraq works for the American people, not just for the Iraqi people. It can't, at this price, just be a humanitarian operation. I think the public can be there, but
sure.
I think what we all need to be clear that the president needs to be clear that this is something he cares about. And one of the things that has been very disturbing about the way the administration has been run over the past couple of years is that with things like this immigration proposal, with things like, I won't go into all the unhappiness, but with that, the president has too many things that he is trying to do at once. And I think he really did need to decide when the war began to run into trouble that this was going to be his top priority, and then just overburdening both his supporters and the American political system with too many other things. And the and that's one of the many reasons why his immigration proposals were so lethal to him, because he gave a lot of conservative Republicans an opportunity to move away from him on something where he just wasn't in harmony with the spirit of the party. He also was, I think, wrong on the merits.
Well, that's actually a great segue into my next sort of set of questions for you, which is, you wrote a devastating critique of the Reagan Revolution and its failures, and also George H.W. Bush's presidency in Dead Right, and particularly the scene setters, the scenes that you wrote about from the convention in Houston. How would you compare, with your book coming out this fall, the father to the son, and where are they similar, where are they different?
Well, as leaders and managers, they're very, very different. Ideologically, we've moved to a position where, and I think a lot of the work of the conservative revolution really is completed. And I think this is the thing I was struggling with in 1994 when I wrote Dead Right. I didn't quite want to face up to that. That the policy conclusion of Dead Right was one last big heave. While I stand by all of the analysis in that book, I think that the suggestions at the end, I don't think they meet the test of time. As what I didn't want to face up to was, look, the work of the conservative movement came together in the 1970s. It was largely a response, or the popular, the electoral conservative coalition, the thing that elected presidents and members of Congress here in the 1970s in response to a series of crises over crime, over the seeming crack up of American society, over foreign policy challenges. And much of the conservative agenda was implemented. The only thing deader than failed ideas are completed ideas. Or the only thing almost is dead. I mean, they're done. They're done. No one is going to hire you to take a political victory lap. No one wants to see inflation stopped again just for the heck of it. It's stopped. It's not coming back.
Well, Right, but you in Dead Right talked a lot about how Reagan, in fact, failed to shrink. He expanded the size of the federal government. And certainly in the war on terrorism, we've seen an expansion of the worst part of the government, the secret, unaccountable side of the government. So, yeah. I mean, I think there's still some work for Hayekian conservatives, you know, sort of to trace it back to the notion that creeping liberalism will lead you ultimately to socialism.
But when socialism is sort of is a dead idea, you know, one of the things that gave conservatism a lot of its power, when you look back on the conservative fights in the 60s and 70s, the lines in the sand are often drawn quite arbitrarily. I think it's the nature of politics. But conservatives would rally to fight things because they knew that the Democrats in Congress would propose something or some increase in the cost of government, or and it would be the first step on the slippery slope toward the total abolition of private property. So
sure.
Fight everything. But post-Clinton, post-Rubin, I don't think today's Democratic Party is on the way to the total abolition of private property. And that means that when they come up with some idea, but it might not be. But you also can't assume that even what used to happen was, even when they came up with something that sounded like it might be a good idea, you still had to oppose it because you knew where they were going with this. They were going to take you. Britain was Britain under Clement Attlee, and if you didn't fight them on the end of the land, they would. You know, the next thing you knew, well, so it goes. I think today it's the world's different, and that means. I think when socialism dies, it takes anti-socialism with it.
Okay. That is an interesting point. But I still am worried about the Directorate of National Intelligence, the expansion of the Department of Homeland Security.
Okay.
And I think that conservatives are in that vein will spend the next generation in part worrying about. I don't want to get conspiratorial, but. Certainly the temptation
Don't.
To creep towards a big brother state.
That's not the problem. That's not the problem. I mean, the problem, and this is one of the ways where I think if you really want to blame the Bush administration, I mean, what an unbelievable thing that in the 21st century somebody would respond to a problem like the 9/11 problem by creating a big 1930s-style new bureaucracy like the Department of Homeland Security. I don't know, I mean, actually, let me appeal to the conspiracy theorists. Do you remember there was a thing called, I forget another term, I think total information awareness.
Yes.
They were going to create futures markets in predicting events. I think this was an idea of John Poindexter's.
Yes.
A brilliant, brilliant mathematical mind, brilliant policy mind, not maybe the most sensitive political person in the world. Now, you know, that was the way, that was something that was proposed in a way that ended up being quite provocative and shocking. But when you think about it, 21st century societies with their distributed information networks, I mean, that's how they're going to find things out, is by finding mechanisms so that individuals can pool knowledge and information. The idea that, I mean, the problem with the Department of Homeland Security and all this is not that they're sinister, is that they're going to be creaky and incompetent and stupid. You know, and I think that we all have that sense. I mean, what's the threat level today? Who knows? Who cares? I mean,
right.
You've got five colors. Anyone who's flown. I mean, I remember for a year, almost a year after 9/11, going through the metal detectors into the White House, as the staff had to do. And what you do is you present your badge and you go up to the metal detectors, and you'd walk through and, you know, you put your keys and so on. And what I would often be doing, many people would, you'd go to pick up a coffee, you'd get some air, pick up a coffee, you'd put the coffee on the side and go through the metal detector. And I always had the idea for a thriller novel that was about somebody packing his styrofoam coffee full of some kind of terrorist weapon, plastic explosive or germ, and putting it outside the metal. Now, they now make you put the coffee through the metal detector.
Right.
But it took months to figure out that you should do that. That's the problem, that the government, that we are trying to fight. I mean, Al-Qaeda is a 21st century kind of threat. It's a distributed network. It doesn't have a big central command. It doesn't have, you know, the German high command in charge of it. And I think they were right. The Republicans were right the first time in the Department of Homeland Security. It was a bad idea.
I think that, yes, I agree with you on that argument, too. But I also think that there's a fight right now in Washington. And we might be seeing the winners right now in Admiral McConnell and Tom Fingar. to be the sort of indispensable James Jesus Angleton or J. Edgar Hoover of our generation who knows the history of everything and will be the sort of indispensable bureaucrat. And what I'm worried about, I'm not worried, I don't think that, you know, the television cameras on the stoplights and so forth in our cities are really used to sort of keep an eye on you and that there's a file in some Department of Homeland Security system where they're going to make sure that, you know, they track all of your online purchases. That I'm not worried about. But I am just worried about bureaucracies overruling politics. And I don't trust this new bureaucracy to tell us when the threat is diminished. More importantly, the reason I supported, you know, an aggressive sort of, you know, idea of regime change abroad is because I think that if we play defense and create these sort of bureaucracies, we are setting up a recipe for institutionalizing these sorts of protocols. They should expire at some point. At some point, I mean, I think that we can agree that for now, while we're at an incredible threat, we may be willing to stomach some suspension of the writ of habeas corpus in some cases for prisoners of war or even American citizens who have made pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda. But certainly that's not the kind of thing that you want institutionalized over a long period of time. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. Well, the first Patriot Act came with the Sunset Clause.
Yes.
And I think it would be a good thing if a lot of laws came attached to Sunset Clauses, especially national security laws. We also have elections, and I think that those provide opportunities to rethink things.
Well, but the election of 2004 did not manage to clean up the CIA, did it?
No.
I mean, it tried it with Porter Goss, but they brought back the guys he fired essentially. And, you know, the national security bureaucrats won.
And I think one of the, we can see, we're going to see, I think, some competitiveness actually also among countries. That the British right now are launching a huge new effort to revamp their approach to internal security, which is a very serious problem for them, obviously. Mm-hmm. And the deal they're making is that they are going to seek greater cooperation from their internal Muslim community in exchange for ideologically ratifying some of the demands of the more extreme members of that community. And the hope is that they can purchase cooperation through ideological concession.
Yes.
Purchase security cooperation through ideological concession. So we'll see how that works. David Reif, who's a very smart guy, has an article in the current Sunday magazine of the New York Times in which he argues that this might do some good. And,
surprise.
You know, be an
yes.
Well, you know,
I think he's a smart guy, too.
You don't think so, I don't think so.
But he's written in the last 7 years, anyway.
But you don't think so, I don't think so. But it might be true, and we'll see. The British are going to do the experiment whether we like it or not.
Right.
The French are going to do some other kinds of experiments. This problem is going to be with us for a long time. One of the things, though, that I find remarkable, you know, as much as people worry about maybe the government going too far after 9/11, is, and this is maybe one of Bush's many self-inflicted vulnerabilities, that the idea that you would respond to 9/11 by having really no additional increment at all of border control is just remarkable. And I say this as a Canadian Canadian immigrant to the United States. I think it was in 2006 that Middle Eastern immigration to the United States hit an all-time high. Now, that could be a good thing. I mean, there are many people in the Middle East who are committed to American liberal values and want out and want to come here and want to contribute. Mm-hmm. But you'd want to check that pretty carefully with that group of people. And as far as I can find out, there is no, and it remains the Barney Frank law that forbids the Immigration Service to consider membership in an extremist organization.
Is that true?
Granting or denying. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Horrible.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
The under American law, you can be barred from the United States if you are a member of a designated terrorist organization. So if you are Lebanese and you belong to Hezbollah and you apply for a student visa to the United States, you'll be told no. But if you belong to the Friends of Hezbollah, if you belong to something that is an extremist group that is not a designated terrorist group, and if you belong, in other words, to any group that an American citizen has a First Amendment right to belong to, and that's the standard.
Hezbollah is for Palestinian
right,
justice.
Exactly. Then you cannot be denied a visa. And this is was a big push of Barney Frank and Ted Kennedy's in the 1990s. I assume it had something to do with Irish-American politics. I don't know. But that's remarkable. That's remarkable to me. And that has not changed since 9/11.
Oh, that is a remarkable thing. Well, anyway, that's incredible. Anyway, let's move on, because I'm sure our viewers of Blogging Heads who tend to skew to the left, I don't think that's an unfair, no, I know, never, are wondering when I'm going to get around to asking you about how you started World War IV, David, with this Axis of Evil speech that you wrote, knowing full well that you would provoke these perfectly non-belligerent mullahs in Iran to do all these nasty things that they're alleged to be doing now, not to mention, anger the rest of the world and alienate us and so forth. And anyway, because this speech that you helped write in 2002, and I'm assuming at the end of 2001, has become, it has become a central talking point for the kind of Juan Cole contingent, and also a lot of Democrats that want to sort of argue that it was this excess of rhetoric and excess of the neocon influence that has provoked a lot of our enemies, which is why we're in the predicament we are in. So what do you have to say to you for yourself?
Well, two things. First, I want to do a commercial. If it is true, as you say, the Blogging Head audience is left of center, then I want to invite them, because today is a big day in the Frum household. It's the release date for my wife's new book, which should appeal to left of center readers, which is this book of parody she wrote of the president's secret instant messages. So that's
Are they parodies?
Right? No, they're
or are they parodies? right.
But look, here's one of the things that separates. One of the things that I think we on the right have to learn from the left is to appreciate that people other than ourselves have agency, have motives, that the world that the world is not simply Western peoples acting and non-white, non-Western peoples, the victims of history. They have agency, too. They act for their own reasons.
Right.
And that lesson gets forgotten when we discuss the problems of the Middle East. The Iranians have aspirations and ambitions of their own. For example, the reason they want a nuclear bomb is not because President Bush spoke harshly about them in 2002. It was because they remember the lesson of the 1980s when the United States used naval power to defend Kuwait from Iranian missiles. And Iran could not deter the United States. And they want a nuclear weapon as a way of deterring the United States from ever doing anything like reflagging the Kuwaiti vessels again. I think that's just childish. I mean, and the president was driven to that kind of talk in 2002 precisely because of the accumulated evidence that Iran had become a serious geopolitical threat to the United States and its friends, that the Iranians were doing all kinds of terrible things, including harboring elements of al-Qaeda, that the Khatami so-called detente was a ripoff and disaster. I think presidents obviously have to be very careful about the language they use. And I think in 2001, 2002, we can blend. And I think the comments like the old Europe comment by Donald Rumsfeld, those weren't helpful. Don't alienate your friends. But speak candidly to and about your enemies. You don't always want to do that, but there are times when you do. And 2001 and 2002 was an important moment to do that.
Do you think that, in retrospect, given that we reached out to the Iranians for both Afghanistan and Iraq by working with their proxies to form the government that replaced Saddam, but also we explored a possible swap between the Mujahideen Khalq and these al-Qaeda leaders who escaped from Afghanistan, do you think, in retrospect, that including Iran and the Axis of Evil hindered the diplomacy, which I happen to know in January 2002 was already underway.
Yeah.
Saying we knew they were doing bad stuff, but maybe sometimes it's best not to kind of announce that publicly in such an important speech if your plan for the next year is to work with the Iranians in the lead up to the Iraq war to help as everyone at the time was saying afterwards and at the time that it, help have Iran, act in its interest to stabilize Iran.
Yeah. Well, I think your question points to what I would consider the most powerful criticism of what happened in 2001, 2002, which is that there has often been a disconnect between what this administration says and what it does. And you need to think in advance about what you intend to do So you cannot, what they would sometimes happen in the Bush administration was that they would emancipate the speechwriters, and they would say, you guys go ahead, and you write. I think it was Frederick the Great who had this line that to Voltaire, that my subjects and I have reached an understanding. They may say as they please, and I do what I please. And sometimes sometimes that seemed to be the deal that governed the Bush administration, that the speechwriters got to write what they wanted, and the permanent government did what it wanted. So, yes, if you are going to pursue that approach to Iran, then by all means, don't say those things in the Axis of Evil speech. If you give the green light to the Axis of Evil speech, and like it's not like me saying on my own, what should U.S. policy, or Mike Gerson and I, or any eight people, saying what should U.S. policy in the Middle East be? Let's put it in the president's speech, and he'll read it on television. That's not how it works. That when green-lighted to do those things, we inferred that there was that this was this expression, the summit, of a calculated series of policy decisions, that it was that given the choice of evils before the United States, it was better to call the Iranians on their mischief than to try to work with them. And I think what has been sort of troubling has been that the rhetoric was disconnected from the policy. And given the policy that was actually followed, the rhetoric, I think, misled everybody. I mean, in some ways that was salutary, and then I think it gave the Iranians a shock that probably was good for them. But it was a shock that they quickly became habituated to.
Interesting. So you can see that in retrospect, if we were going to follow the policies, as you say, of the permanent government, but clearly, I mean, the president signs off on this. I mean, there is this view among some of us, you know, the president's being undermined by all of his people in the government. And I never bought that. I mean, he can fire a lot of the people who clearly were, you know, at cross purposes with what he wanted to do.
You have to fire a lot of people, and then you have to rehire people in a coherent way. And so you have, yes, you could do that if you made, and I've often, part of this takes us back to the story of the recount and the way that Bush came into government. It takes us into other kinds of problems as well. But yes, from the beginning, you would have to launch yourself onto a program of reorganization. That said, I think it is difficult for presidents to generate their own policy options. The presidents end up choosing from finite menus of options, and it's other people who generate those menus of options for them.
Yeah, okay, I think that's, all right. Yes. But anyway, that was a very interesting response on the Axis of Evil speech, and I think it gets us into what will be our final topic for discussion, which is one of the things we like to talk about, I guess, in our private phone calls, which are not broadcast on the Blogging Heads, which is what's wrong with the Democrats. I really do think that they are. My theory is that right now they're playing to their base, which, you know, it's, you could call it a McGovern base. It's sort of, I mean, they're sort of a neutralist base, which is to say that they are convinced they are the chickens coming home to roost guys. And so the position for the leadership of the Congress, as well as all of the major candidates, is let's get the troops out as soon as possible. Do you think that they're going to tack to the center once they have a nominee, and that the Netroots will find themselves alone and dateless?
Parties are like families, and it's a little hard sometimes for outsiders to understand how they work. And by the way, I appreciate the reference to our private phone calls, and I will not make any reference to the heavy breathing methods you use to extract.
I'm sorry. Did I betray a confidence there? I didn't mean to.
Otherwise, this is going to be too much like the U.S. Senate. My learned friend, my distinguished colleague.
Exactly. Right.
What is going to happen to them? It's a big country, and that's easy to forget when you're in the middle of political activism. I mean, in some ways, this election is going to be for the Democrats what 1980 was for the Republicans. That is, that they have the wind at the back, their opponents are weakened, and so they will have an opportunity to go a little bit more to their ideological base than they otherwise might have done. I mean, in 1976, the Republicans could never have dared to nominate a Ronald Reagan. In 1980, they could dare. And so the Democrats could do that a little bit more. Does that mean that they nominate somebody other than Hillary Clinton? Does that mean that Hillary Clinton herself reinvents herself as a more left-wing person than she's presented herself as till now. I don't understand that party well enough to predict that. But they do have that opportunity. It's always a dangerous opportunity, and it is worth remembering that while the country has become somewhat more democratic, quite a lot more democratic over the past 7 years, it hasn't become that much more liberal. That when you ask people in polls, conservative or independent, that the number of liberals remains much smaller of conservatives. If I remember right, it's about a fifth of the country calls itself liberal and about a third of the country calls itself conservative, and those ratios have been pretty steady since the 1970s. So they have a tremendous opportunity to make a mistake, and I think last week in Congress they made one of their very first really serious mistakes since the 2006 elections when they voted to axe this John Doe law. You may know about this. This is the law that immunizes, I think, people, the passengers on airplanes, if they report seeing something suspicious. It was prompted by an incident on a U.S. Airways flight where passengers did see behavior by a group of imams that they thought was suspicious. It sounds pretty suspicious. The imams, however, were not up to no good, and they then filed lawsuits, or at least they were not engaged in terrorism. They may have been engaged in some kind of political demonstration. But they brought lawsuits against the passengers who filed the complaint, and those lawsuits apparently are proceeding. So legislation is brought forward in Congress to immunize passengers. And stealthily, not on the floor, but the Democratic majority helped to axe this thing. And that's, to my mind, an indication
of... It looks like they're catering to care.
Yes, and that, and
right.
Also, by the way, to the trial lawyer lobby. I think that's a big part of it. That what do you mean? You begin by axing frivolous lawsuits against people who report suspicious activities, and the next thing you know, you put the whole asbestos and tobacco litigation industry out of business, and we can't have that. That, I think, was a real error, and I think it is an issue that Republicans would be wise to bring forward again and again and again, because whether it's about the trial lawyers or whether it's about multiculturalism, it reminds people that there are elements of the Democratic Party that do not put the defense of the country before all other priorities. And that may be these temptations you're talking about at work. We'll see.
Do you think that at this point that Hillary would be wise to distance herself? I mean, she's going to the yearly COSE meeting this weekend. She's mm-hmm. going to give a speech. And what I've heard from people close to Hillary, and I do not have fantastic Hillary sources, I can tell you that, but what I've recently heard is that she's just playing that they don't actively hate her. That if they can just be neutral on Hillary and not go out of their way to just see that how horrible she is, then that's okay. Do you think, though, that Hillary would be wise at some point to sort of turn the Cossacks, their word, not mine, Cossacks, think about that anyway, into a kind of sister soldier?
Yeah. I think she has a problem. I think it is going to be hard for her ever to persuade the country as a whole that she is a middle-of-the-road figure. And not impossible, but hard. On the other hand, I think it, as a general rule, I mean, I would, of course, be delighted to see her tell the Cossacks where to get off. And when you read some of the things in their comment page, you realize they're called Cossacks for a reason. But I would be delighted for her to do that. I'm not sure from her point of view that would be a smart thing to do. That picking a fight with your party is something you do only under the most
She looks
special
like the president on immigration.
Yeah. What is that?
She looks like she has the problems. She looks like the president on immigration. The president picked a fight with his base on
right.
the immigration bill by implying they were racists.
Right, exactly. And that didn't work out so well.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, listen, it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much, David Frum.
Eli, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.